Broadcast Blue is all about the legal aspects of law enforcement and all of the cases of the week or the topics that I select for these podcast episodes revolve around one of the different legal aspects of law enforcement. It's usually search and seizure law, and more often than not, it deals with searches and not seizures. But today, we have an interesting case, a very recent case, that allows us to explore the concept of the seizure of a person.
Bringing you the latest case law updates on the legal aspects of law enforcement. This is Broadcast Blue.
Hello, my name is Bruce Allen Barnard, and I want to welcome you to this episode of Broadcast Blue. The case that I'm going to be discussing in this episode is United States versus Gaines. This is a decision that came from the 10th Circuit, and the date of the opinion is March 12, 2019. The key phrases are seizure, attenuation doctrine, search incident to arrest, and inventory. Let's take a look at the facts. So this all started with a 911 call back on the morning of August 24th, 2015. The police in Kansas City, Kansas, received a 911 call reporting that a man dressed in red had just sold drugs in a parking lot and described where the parking lot was. Based on the information from the 911 call, police officers Carl Rowland and Shanae Davis responded. The police officers pulled into a parking lot in two separate police cars and then turned on the lights, their roof lights, to their vehicles. They parked behind a car that had a man inside, and he was dressed. He was in red clothing, and this was Mr. Gaines. And Mr. Gaines was seated in the driver's side of the vehicle. Both officers are uniformed, and they both get out of their separate vehicles, and they approach Gaines. Officer Rowland uses his hand, and he gestures at Gaines to tell him to get out of the vehicle through the hand gesture. As a result of this, Gaines got out, and Officer Rowland confronted Gaines with the report that he was selling PCP in the parking lot. As this was going on, the other officer is circling around Gaines' car and looking inside. So the police officers soon observed an open container of alcohol and also reportedly smelled PCP. When they told Mr. Gaines that they were going to detain him, he grabbed a pouch from inside the car and fled. He ran off. And as he was running away, he threw the pouch away. Gaines was caught by the two officers, who then searched his car and found cocaine, marijuana, PCP, various drug paraphernalia, cash, over $600 in cash, and a handgun. After searching the vehicle, the officers discovered Gaines had an outstanding warrant for his arrest, and he was arrested on that warrant. So Gaines is prosecuted for the possession of all these drugs. And in the United States District Court for the District of Kansas. And you know what's going to happen. The defense attorney is going to use the defense F word. That's not fair. Arguing that there was some violation of the Fourth Amendment that took place so they can invoke the exclusionary rule and have this evidence thrown out. And so there's a motion to suppress that's filed in order in an attempt to have this evidence thrown out. And at the trial level, the district court ruled that the encounter that the officers had with Mr. Gaines up until the point that he fled and took off and threw the pouch away was a consensual encounter, and it was not a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. As a result, the district court denied the motion to suppress the evidence. And Mr. Gaines, through his attorney, appealed. And so on appeal, we've got these two issues that are going up to the 10th Circuit. The first issue, when the two uniformed police officers approached Mr. Gaines with the flashing roof lights and confronted him about the report that he was selling PCP, about that 911 call, did this confrontation constitute a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes? And the second issue, after effecting a seizure, assuming that it was a seizure, the police allegedly acquired probable cause and learned of an outstanding arrest warrant. The issue is, the question is, did the development of probable cause or the subsequent discovery of the arrest warrant attenuate the connection between the seizure and the evidence? Okay, since we have two separate issues, let's take a look at the analysis of each of these issues separately. So the first analysis is whether or not these actions constituted a seizure on the part of when the officers approached him, whether or not Mr. Gaines was seized for Fourth Amendment purposes. Because remember, all Fourth Amendment, all government searches and seizures must be reasonable. And in order to be reasonable, you either have to have probable cause or one of the judicially recognized exceptions, including in a seizure situation, the possibility of having an investigative detention or a Terry stop. So the very first question is, was this a seizure? Did the actions of the officers constitute a seizure of Mr. Gaines for Fourth Amendment purposes? And we have two separate questions that we have to look at, and two separate parts of the analysis. And the first question is, would a reasonable person believe they were free to end the encounter? Remember, a seizure, whether or not a person is seized, is not what they believe subjectively. It is what would the reasonable person, at least theoretically an objective test, you know, the old legal fiction reasonable person. What would a reasonable person think? Would a reasonable person believe that they were free to end the encounter? And that's the question. And it's a question of law for the court to determine based on the totality of the circumstances here. And so let's look at the facts that the court thought were relevant in order to reach a conclusion on this question of whether a reasonable person would believe they were free to end the encounter. So one fact that was very important to the court was the fact that there were two uniformed officers in separate cars that pulled up right behind Gaines while he was parked in his vehicle in a parking lot with their lights on, the roof lights on the patrol cars were on. And the court also noted that under Kansas state law, the law requires a person to stop when lights are flashing. So they pull up behind them with the lights flashing. Under Kansas law, a person's required to stop when that happens, which is one more factor to consider here. And then the court noted that one of the officers gestured for Gaines to get out of his vehicle. And then once he was out of his vehicle, an officer confronted Gaines with the report that a man in red clothes was selling PCP in the parking lot. So they're confronting him with the report they've had of someone matching his description selling PCP. And while this is happening, the other officer is circling around Gaines's car looking inside. And the court said, based on these 5 points and these facts, these factors, that a reasonable person would not believe that they were free to end the encounter at this point. But there's one more question. There's one more point here. Did Gaines yield to the police officer's show of authority? That's required. There's a Supreme Court decision from back in 1991, the California versus Hodari case. And so they have to, there has to be, the person has to yield in order for it to be a seizure. The officers can show their authority, but unless the person yields to that authority, a seizure doesn't occur. And so the question is, did Gaines actually yield to the police officer's show of authority? Now, the officers argue, and the government argued, that he did not, because he grabbed the bag, the pouch in the car, and ran off. But the Tenth Circuit said that the officer's action gesturing him out of the vehicle constituted the show of authority, and when he exited the vehicle as he was directed to do through the gesture, Gaines submitted to that authority, and therefore the seizure took place prior to him running off, and that a seizure, that there was a seizure at that point. And so the answer to the first part of the first issue, whether or not this constituted a seizure, the court said that it did. So having determined that the answer to the first question, the first issue on appeal, was yes, that the actions did constitute a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes, the court went on to the second issue to determine whether or not the development of probable cause or the subsequent discovery of the arrest warrant, if either one of those situations attenuated the connection between the seizure and the evidence such that the exclusionary rule would not apply. And this is what's called the attenuation doctrine. So the government has two bites that they're going to take at the attenuation doctrine apple here. And the first one is, the first argument is going to be based on the warrant argument, the fact that a warrant was discovered. And their argument is that when a warrant was discovered, once they discovered a warrant, the car would have been searched incident to arrest or inventoried. So through one of those two methods, they would have discovered this evidence. This evidence would have been found as a result of the outstanding warrant, and therefore the attenuation, it was attenuated enough, the attenuation doctrine should apply in order to allow for the evidence to come in based on this. And so here the evidence at issue was in Mr. Gaines's car. And if the police had arrested Mr. Gaines based on the arrest warrant, he might or might not have been within the reach of the car at the time of the search. And if he's not within reach, if the car is not within reach, then the police could not have searched the car incident to arrest. Remember Arizona versus Gantt back in 2009 regarding this issue of the search incident to arrest of a vehicle. We don't exactly know what the outstanding warrant was for, but when someone's arrested on an outstanding warrant, it's very unlikely that the evidence for which the person is being arrested on the warrant will be found within the vehicle under one of those two Gantt exceptions there that were espoused. And so the court quickly dismissed the concept that they would have found this through a search incident to arrest, because it all depends on where he would have been. There's no evidence to show when he was arrested that he was in the car was in his lunging distance, and evidence of the crime for which he'd been arrested would be found in the vehicle. And then, so they moved on. They said, well, even if it's not a search incident to arrest, even if the search incident to arrest doesn't apply, it would be an inventory search. They would have impounded and inventoried the vehicle, and they would have found this evidence through an inventory search. Remember, inventory searches are not full-blown criminal searches. You don't get to search everywhere in an inventory that you would search in a criminal investigative search. You search in places where people would normally store personal property. And so it's a search, but it's somewhat limited. But the stuff that was found, the evidence that was found in the area of a car where an inventory search would be conducted if it could be lawfully conducted. And the court noted that in this case, the government did not present any evidence of the standardized criteria for impounding the vehicle. Remember, before you can properly inventory a vehicle, you have to be able to lawfully impound the vehicle. The police can impound the car or impound the vehicle only upon proof of a community caretaking rationale. For example, if the car was obstructing traffic or somehow imperiled public safety. And the court referred back to the Supreme Court decision, South Dakota versus Opperman, for that construct. But the court noted here, the Tenth Circuit noted, that they lacked any evidence that the car was illegally parked or imperiling public safety. So the court couldn't determine that the car would have been able to be impounded lawfully, which has to happen. That's the precursor to having the inventory take place, is the lawful impounding of the vehicle. But the court went on and they said, even assuming for argument's sake that either the search incident to the arrest or inventory would have yielded the same results, the court could apply the attenuation doctrine only after considering three factors. The first factor is the temporal proximity between the Fourth Amendment violation and the discovery of the evidence. The second factor is the presence of intervening circumstances. And the third factor is the purpose and flagrancy of the officer's wrongdoing. The court noted that the first two factors favored suppression of the evidence. They weighed in Gaines's favor, and only the third factor arguably favored the government. The first factor regarding temporal proximity supported Mr. Gaines because the evidence was discovered only minutes after the seizure took place. And the court cited the Supreme Court decision from a couple years ago, Utah versus Streff, for that construct. The second factor supported Mr. Gaines because the arrest warrant wasn't discovered until after the search took place. And so there wasn't an intervening circumstance. It was after the search had already occurred. And the third factor, the purpose and flagrancy of the wrongdoing, supported the government. The court noted that the police officers arguably should have known that the encounter constituted a seizure. But the district court had found that the police had been negligent at worst. And the finding was reasonable because the issue of reasonable suspicion was close. Whether or not they had reasonable suspicion just based on the information they had prior to approaching him. He could have been seized with reasonable suspicion. It could have that he was involved in criminal activity, right? It would have been a Terry stop if they had a reasonable suspicion. And so if the search had been unlawful, police would at worst have been negligent. So that third factor worked in favor of the government. But the first two factors worked in favor of Mr. Gaines, and therefore applying this analysis, the attenuation doctrine did not apply because of the existence of the warrant. But we're not finished with the attenuation doctrine yet, because the government also argued that the officers had established probable cause when they smelled PCP and had observed an open container in the car. And therefore, the development of this probable cause would have triggered the attenuation doctrine. But the court rejected flatly that argument because according to the government, the police officers obtained the probable cause when they smelled the PCP and observed an open container in his car. But even if probable cause existed, it would have flowed directly from the seizure itself. In other words, the unlawful seizure is what led to the development of the probable cause. And you can't use what you subsequently find to justify the lawfulness of the action that comes in before it. And the attenuation doctrine, there's nothing to attenuate. It's a direct result. The observations that they claim led to the development of probable cause, the open container, the view of the open container, and the odor, that distinctive odor of the PCP, that led directly from the seizure that the court has already ruled to be unlawful. There's no attenuation to occur. It's a direct result, and so it's not attenuated in any way. The discovery of the evidence would still be traced directly to this possible Fourth Amendment violation. So given the direct causal connection, the eventual development of probable cause would not trigger the attenuation doctrine. So the court had one more tangential issue to address or to at least mention, and that was, what's the seizure when they stopped him, when they gestured him to get out of the vehicle and the seizure, and he yielded to their authority, when he was seized, was that seizure, that warrantless seizure, justified by reasonable suspicion, by the Terry stop judicially recognized exception, or JRE? Remember, every government search and seizure has to be reasonable. Reasonableness requires either a warrant or a judicially recognized exception. And so the court is determining, or at least taking a look at, did they have a reasonable suspicion that would have justified a seizure under the Terry stop judicially recognized exception? And the court noted that the call that came in was based on, it was a 911 call. And the court looked at a couple of cases, but with a focus on that 2000 decision from the Supreme Court, Navarrete versus California, where the court ruled in a close decision, the court ruled that the 911 call has indicia of reliability. And therefore, it kind of took Alabama versus White one step further, basically using the fact that it was a 911 call itself with that indicia of reliability in order to establish reasonable suspicion just based on the call itself. And the court said, hey, look, the district court's better suited in order to make these factual determinations. They didn't make those determinations before. It was the district court had held that it was a consensual encounter, and so they didn't get into these side arguments and these side discussions and didn't have any findings of fact regarding whether or not reasonable suspicion had existed. So the Tenth Circuit vacated the district court's denial of the motion to suppress, and they sent it back down. It was remanded back to the district court in order to take a look at whether or not the officers had reasonable suspicion when they made the stop. So it's not over. Even though the Tenth Circuit vacated the denial of the motion to suppress, and it's going to go back down to the lower court, it's not over yet, because it's possible that the lower court will rule that the officers did have a reasonable suspicion based on the 911 call, based on their observations, what they saw, matching the 911 call, what the caller said, and also making some determinations about the 911 call itself, about whether or not the person making the call saw it firsthand or was told to them secondhand. Then the factors that you would normally look at to look for the indicia of reliability in establishing a level of suspicion, including that reasonable suspicion, it's going to have to all be determined back at the lower court, kicking it down to the district court for that determination. Now, it is important to note there was one judge on the panel that said, hey, well, I've got enough facts. We've got enough facts here, and went ahead and held that there was reasonable suspicion. But the majority of the other two judges said that that's something the district court needs to determine, and it was remanded back to the lower court for that determination. So we'll have to see what happens. And, you know, looking at the facts and applying the law, it's quite possible, if not likely, that the district court will rule that the officers did have reasonable suspicion when this occurred. But the main gist of this case and the main point for us is this concept of what constitutes a seizure of a person. Remember, it's an objective standard. Would a reasonable person believe that they were free to end the encounter? And it's going to be based on a whole bunch of factors under a totality of the circumstances when the court's going to take a really good look at it. And so when you're an LEO, when you start issuing commands to people, you put your lights on under state law, they're required to stop. And then you start issuing commands, and then people follow these commands and yield to that show of authority, you're probably going to have a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And so you need to understand that and understand what constitutes a seizure in order to determine that first question we always deal with search and seizure issues, which is, does the Fourth Amendment even apply? This episode of Broadcast Blue has been brought to you by Leah One. Leah One, providing high-quality professional training in the legal aspects of law enforcement. There is a great advanced search and seizure law class. The 8-hour advanced search and seizure law course from Leah One will be in Alexandria, Virginia, on May the 6th. So if you're in that D.C. area and you're looking for a good 8-hour fast-paced, interactive, advanced search and seizure law course, recommend that to you. Check it out. You can go to the website at www.lea.one. Leah One. Their name is their website address. It doesn't get much more convenient than that. And if you want to host a course, if you don't want to have a course, have to send officers to a course at some location, if you want to host a course right in your department, you can. Leah One can do that for you as well. And you can email for your inquiries for that to comms at leah.agency, agency, comms@leah.agency, if you have any questions or if you're interested in hosting Leah One training at your particular site. Thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate you taking the time to tune in. Remember, you can subscribe to Broadcast Blue on iTunes and Google Play, or you can listen right on the browser itself at www.broadcast.blue. Going to have another episode coming up really soon. Going to be, I'll see you folks, the people coming to the training we're going to be doing in Winter Haven, Florida, on the 28th, the day after tomorrow. I'll see you down there. If you're a Broadcast Blue subscriber, please make sure you come up and say hello. I'd love to meet you. And for you supervisors. The supervisors out in the Midwest, the National Park Service out in Omaha, Nebraska. I'll see you next week. We're going to have a day of fun, a great legal refresher, legal update out there in Omaha for the NPS alert for the managers, the NPS supervisors out there in Omaha, Nebraska. I'll see you in a week. Thank you so much for what you do, and I hope to see you again here real soon on Broadcast Blue.